What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Two Woke Nerds podcast, and I am so excited for this week. I have with me on the show tonight easily my best-looking co-host that I've ever had. The only one that I will slip up and probably call something like babe or dear. My wonderful wife, Adrian, is with us on the show tonight. Babe, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing fantastic, and I hope Ray doesn't mind that this week I'm going to call you my very own chocolate bear.
Man, I don't know. he's going to send an angry text.
I'm sure he will.
Certain.
Ray, I love you. I hope you understand.
Yeah, when is Ray not sending angry texts? Let's just be honest here. Yeah, so tonight we're going to dive into a little bit of news, as we always do. Some big news in Marvel TV. Some trailers came out this week, and some crazy weird news coming from Disney. And then we're going to dive into a subject that only my wife could come on the show to discuss with me: Disney movies. So we're going to talk Disney movies for a few minutes. Before we do that, we're going to dive into some news. So the biggest news, if you've listened to our show for any amount of time, you know I'm super excited about this. Marvel has finally released the trailer for the new Iron Fist Netflix show. Adrian, it feels weird calling you by your actual name. What were your impressions? You're my Netflix buddy, obviously, because we're married and that's how marriage works.
Right.
So what were your impressions of the new trailer to come out from Netflix?
You know, I'm excited about it. I am coming into this completely green. I have no frame of reference for anything Marvel other than the cinematic universe that I've been so wonderfully educated on throughout our relationship.
I said some sarcasm in there.
No, it has been wonderful. I mean, it's something that I wasn't super into before we started dating and got married, but I've really enjoyed learning about to the point where I'm now looking forward to the movies, and I may not do as much research on my own as you do, per se, but I do enjoy it. This does look like a really intriguing series. It's probably the one that I've been the most excited about since Daredevil, and so I feel really great about it.
Yeah, I think it's, to me, like you said, I think the action in it looks like it's going to be the best since the first season, even, of Daredevil. I think, you know, we're in the middle of Luke Cage trying to polish that off so we can finally do a podcast about it. But the action in Luke Cage so far has been good, not great. And I think some of the fight scenes in the trailer are reminiscent of, like, that hallway fight scene.
Absolutely.
In the first season, and it kind of gave me that same feeling. I'm really excited because it looks like it's really hinting at the bigger mythology of Iron Fist. You see Madame Gao from season one of Daredevil came back.
Super excited about that. She was my favorite villain of, other than Fisk, but she was my favorite villain of season one, Daredevil. Yeah.
And they hint that she's going to be the Crane mother, who is really involved in, like, the backstory of Iron Fist. And there's a really good run of Ed Brubaker, who wrote The Winter Soldier, that did on Iron Fist that heavily involves her and her champion, Davos the Steel Serpent. And actually, again, going back into season one, like, the symbol on her packets of drugs,
right,
is the Steel Serpent symbol. So, and even, like, the fact that it's a voiceover by Lei Kung, the Thunderer. He's, like, Iron Fist's master martial artist teacher. So I'm excited because I think they're hinting at the mythology, and maybe season two goes a little weird and does, like, the immortal weapons and the seven capital cities. I think it'd be super cool to see some of that. The glowing hands, they finally showed the glowing hands. I thought, right, they were going to look dumb.
They didn't. And I for some reason, had a mental image of flaming hands in my mind. I don't know why. I don't know where that came from. But the glow looked good.
Yeah, the flaming hands is kind of the traditional, okay, the way it looks. So you weren't too far off. But no, like, that was the biggest concern. I was like, I don't know how they're going to do that. They could not look terrible. And so, no, it looked fantastic. Like, I thought, it looked like when you watch, like, the Planet Earth documentaries and they show, like, the bioluminescent algae, and right, that's what it looked like. It looked organic.
Yeah. Well, and one thing that I really love about Iron Fist's appearance is that he looks like a normal guy, which I know is really the point of the Defenders versus the Avengers. But I really like that. To me, that makes their powers that much more interesting and intriguing because they aren't visually a superhero. And so it's really cool for me to see him in that pose where he's meditating and he just looks like some guy that works at the IT firm down the hall. And then the next thing you know, he's just going in on everybody in a hallway.
Absolutely. He looks like the guy from your IT department wearing like Walmart slacks and some Chuck Taylors.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm excited. So staying on there, when you watch the trailer, they say the last Defender has arrived. And in that same press conference where they showed this trailer and actually some scenes from Iron Fist, they announced that Sigourney Weaver has been cast as an unnamed villain so far in the Defenders series that's coming in 2017. So, Adrian, what is your, like, Sigourney Weaver, big name, what is your thoughts, feelings, reactions to this casting?
I think it's awesome. I am terrible, absolutely terrible at remembering actors, and I always get Sigourney Weaver mixed up with Susan Sarandon.
It's fantastic.
I think it's just because they both have red hair. Sorry, I can't help it. Yeah. It just is what it is. But whenever even though I can't always remember the roles that she plays, and I somehow always remember Susan Sarandon's roles, I still always associate her with this very powerful, strong character and even a villainous character. And I think that goes back to like her role in Holes, which is, you know, obscure Disney movie. But she is a very evil person in that, and even in the beginning of Avatar, in her character with that, she plays this very strong, sort of takes no crap character. And so I just always associate her with those roles, and I think that she'll be able to really play it up well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Ellen Ripley is who, you know, the big, when you say like strong female characters, like she is the prototype for female heroes and heroines, I guess is the proper term, in sci-fi genre stuff. So I think she's fantastic. You know, you've got Kristen Ritter, who does that really well. You've got Carrie Ann Moss, who's also involved. You know her from The Matrix. So seeing all of these characters, I'm really excited. And it shows, again, how powerful the Marvel machine is. Like, getting Sigourney Weaver, somebody of her caliber, who's been a star since the 70s.
It's huge.
In a Netflix show, like in a straight-to-Netflix miniseries, 8 episodes. So, you know, it goes back to, like, getting Tilda Swinton for Doctor Strange or, you know, all of the big names that they've cast in all of these films. It just shows the staying power of Marvel and how big budget these things have become.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, speaking of power, go, go Power Rangers. So, this weekend, like, New York Comic Con is turning into something big. They dropped, and by they, I mean the studio dropped a new trailer, the only trailer actually, for the Power Rangers reboot. So you and I are of the same-ish generation. There's right. A little bit, couple years.
You're quite a bit older than me.
Quite a bit. Appreciate it. Yeah, just two years. Don't. No, I'm not robbing the cradle here. But we both have a memory of the Power Rangers. So watching the trailer, what was your reaction? What did you think? And really, when push comes to shove, do you think it's going to be a good movie?
Yeah, you know, I realized as I started processing through this that I don't actually remember hardly anything about the original Power Rangers, which is not unlike me. I forget everything. But I remember always being amazed by them, aside from wanting to be the Pink Ranger, as most every girl did. No offense to the Yellow Ranger, but, I mean, Pink reigns supreme. But as I watched through this trailer, it looks like it could be the new Power Rangers, obviously, for this next generation, but even more than that, sort of like the Avengers for Generation Y. Like, it's these new superheroes, and you're watching how they're getting their powers, and it just opens up a whole new possibility, and I can see it, if it's done right, I can see it turning into multiple movies following this and really developing into its own thing, that it's going to be really cool for us as adults to get to, you know, it has that multi-generational appeal. And the key is if it's done right. And from the trailer, I mean, the trailer looks good. I just always sort of don't hold my breath in those sort of situations.
I don't blame you. This has disappointment written all over it. Like, as I watch the trailer, I'm like, it looks like a movie that's lulled me into being excited about it. And Right. Then totally, like the Transformers films, like totally lulled me into like, I'm super excited. And then smack me in the head. I'm mad about it. No, I was pleasantly surprised by the trailer. It looks good. They didn't really give you a ton of the visual effects. I don't know if all of that's done yet. But the actors weren't cheesy. You know, they leaned pretty heavily into, like, the Breakfast Club thing. Totally. Where they're, like, you know, dysfunctional kids and blah, blah, blah. But I thought it looked great that the teen actors, or they're not really teenagers, but the actors playing teenagers looked like they were doing a pretty good job. They gave you, like, the typical, like, Power Rangers color coding.
Right.
Where you saw Billy Cranston, who, side note, the fact that they're, like, getting rid of all of the subtle racism of the Power Rangers... Fantastic. The Yellow Ranger is Hispanic, the Black Ranger is the nerd, and the Black Ranger is the Asian guy. So they're getting rid of, like, that side note. That's fantastic. But I'm excited. The only visual effects shots we got, to the Rita Repulsa thing in the bed, where she's like, right. I've killed Rangers before.
Could you do that again?
Yeah, no, okay. Not at all. We can rewind the podcast. So we got that, and then at the end where you started to see the suit morph onto Jason, it looked cool. Like, I think it could legitimately be cool, but again, I have to reserve the right to be skeptical because I've been burned before.
Totally understandable.
Yeah.
I think you would be unwise not to.
I appreciate that. You married me for my wisdom, did you not?
That is one of the many reasons.
No, not even close. So this is a weird week for news. We got a couple of big stories out of the Disney camp. So Disney is continuing their trend to do live-action reboots of their classic properties. So this week, there was a report that came out that somebody got a hold of the script that they were using for Mulan, and that the lead was going to be a white guy, and people got really mad about that.
Rightly so.
And then the next day, reports came out that said, no, that's just the script that we bought to start from, and we're not actually going to do it, and Mulan is the lead. And then we get news today, actually, that Guy Ritchie of Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch and Revolver and all these weird British, like, indie action films. And then he did the Sherlock Holmes movies, which if Ray was on, he'd be raving about, and I'd be telling him they're overrated. Sorry, Ray, we get to take shots at you this week. Love you, bud. So they have him pegged to do now a live-action version of Aladdin. So we don't really want to dive into the weeds too deep on Disney movies, because that's the next segment.
Right.
But just overall, we have a Jungle Book reboot. Now we're looking at Beauty and the Beast, Lion King, Mulan, Aladdin. Like, what is your thought? Like, what are they trying to accomplish? Like, what are they doing with these live actions? What's your impression of them?
You know, my initial cynical response is, are they running out of ideas? I don't know. They also, you know, they did Cinderella, what was it, last year?
They did. As well. I forgot about Cinderella.
And so I have mixed emotions on it because, you know, people of our age and even older, you know, we hold these movies so near and dear to our childhood. So I have mixed emotions. You know, we saw Jungle Book. We never saw Cinderella.
We didn't.
But I'm not really disappointed that we didn't see it either.
Not
good. Jungle Book was good. It wasn't life changing, but I thought it was pretty solid.
The giant snake changed my life. I didn't sleep that night.
Well, you know, we can get you some therapy.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. But I get a little leery when they start turning a live action movie or turning a cartoon into live action when the original movie was not humans. That's where I start to get a little nervous. So the Lion King news makes me, I have some reservations about that. I just don't see them doing that up to the Lion King standard, something that is so incredibly iconic. But I am excited for Beauty and the Beast, which is interesting because it's inanimate objects that I think can be personified.
You're allowed to contradict yourself.
But I mean, when you have Hermione Granger and Matthew Crawley, like, how could you not be excited?
That's your wheelhouse.
That's it right there. I think that if done right, Mulan could be incredible. And Ray, I'm going to apologize. I don't think I've ever seen a single Guy Ritchie film. I have not seen any of the Sherlock Holmes, nor any of his indie British movies.
I'm failing as a husband. But
well,
that's okay.
It's one of my shortcomings. I'm very thankful that you married me in spite of my lack of film knowledge. But Mulan, I think that it is a Disney princess movie. It is very well known, but I think that there is a lot of leeway in that movie because it's not quite as iconic as Beauty and the Beast, as Cinderella, as Lion King. I think it's kind of on the same level, maybe even as Jungle Book, that it's still a very well-known, powerful movie, but there's a little bit more creative license that could be taken with it, and maybe Guy Ritchie is the guy to do it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Fewer people, I think, have Mulan as a cultural touchstone, and granted, I'm not trying to speak for a whole demographic of people. There are probably a lot of Asian Americans that like strongly identify with Mulan as their you know, princess, just like there are a lot of people that identify with Tiana from Princess and the Frog as their princess, because that's, you know, who you want to identify with, who you see in the mirror. But I think overall, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, movies like Aladdin, The Lion King, those are like Beauty and the Beast. Those are like the A tier, like
upper
the top
echelon.
Tier. Yes. Like when you write home about Disney movies, like those are the first three. Like I'm like, hey, what's a Disney movie? I pop in Aladdin, Lion King, or Beauty and the Beast. One of those three. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Guy Ritchie's movies are so, because they're so like, they're violent and they're like frantic, and I'm intrigued. Like I think some of the action, like the action parts of Aladdin could really do well with his direction. Again, we have to wait and see on this. I'm not a huge Guy Ritchie fan. I think he's very one note. That's my opinion of him. So I'm intrigued to see it. Aladdin has a very big chunk of real estate in my nostalgia bank. So
you and me both. There are those darker themes of Aladdin, though, with Jafar, with him being the sorcerer, with him enslaving them, that, you know, given Guy Ritchie's background, maybe he'll be able to play those up in a new way that was sort of glossed over in a cartoon world.
Yeah, that is a very good point. I didn't think about that, but no, you're absolutely right. So now that we're just going to dive deep
let's
on Disney.
Do it.
So let's just jump right in. Our main topic this week is Disney films. I wanted to get my wife on the podcast. I talk about her all the time. She's my favorite person, whatever.
Aww, yeah. I do exist.
She does exist. She's not a figment. And outside of Harry Potter, which we have coming up in a couple of weeks, like Disney is her jam. And so I wanted to just dive into Disney. We're going to do one of our drafts. That's a good way to do something as broad as Disney movies, right? So we're going to dive in. Like Disney is a huge part of anybody of a certain age, you know, anybody that's mid-30s to you know, early 20s, we kind of lived in the Disney Renaissance, you know? So, what made you fall in love with Disney movies? Like, you're a huge fan, so what is your, like, Disney love come from?
You know, I think it comes from the fact that I don't remember living without Disney. It was a part of my childhood as long as I can remember. I had a very close relationship with my grandfather, and he had the biggest Disney VHS collection that I'm sure that he only purchased for us grandkids. He even had some Disney movies on Laserdisc that I remember watching.
That's impressive.
Popeye with Robin Williams, that I only know of watching it on Laserdisc. I don't know if I've ever seen it outside of his Laserdisc player. And there was even a Disney short that I cannot for the life of me remember what it was called, but it was also on Laserdisc, and it was like about a coyote, maybe? I can't remember specifics, but I mean, that was my childhood as long as I can remember. And so my love just comes from it being integral to my upbringing.
Oh, yep. And I feel the same way. I remember my parents have this huge hutch that my mom hates. in the bottom cabinet was just full of VHSs, and we had like 30 of those big white Disney boxes that like creaked when you opened them, and the tapes fell out. I remember like the first cult, like the first cognizance I have of Disney. We were living in Japan at the time. My dad was in the military, and The Lion King was coming out on VHS, and there was a line at the only store on base that was selling it to get it. And my mom's, I can't remember if it was my mom or my mom's friend, but like we called her on the phone in the morning, like, hey, if you get one, pick us one up too.
Right.
And so like we had, like, Miss Doris bought like 4 copies of The Lion King on VHS.
Good old Miss Doris.
Yeah, and sold them back to people. Doris hooked me up with some stuff. She was awesome. So yeah, so like Disney is a part of my like DNA, who I am. So, you know, we talk about our love of Disney films. So what do you think makes a good Disney movie?
You know, I started out with 2 things, and then the more I thought about it, I came up with a couple others. So I'll try not to take too long explaining my logic on this. But the first one is that it has to take you outside of yourself. It needs to elicit a sense of wonder while you're watching it. You know this very well. The listeners haven't got to know me well yet, but I am a cynical person. I'm a skeptical person. I am kind of always waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm just sort of like, okay, cool. So when something does move me, especially a movie, when a movie moves me, it's a big deal. It's very impactful. And so that's sort of number one, is it has to just take me outside of myself. The first, this is sort of 1B, but, you know, having it be something totally new and innovative, I think that that's something that's really critical to Disney movies, is that they are constantly innovating, and that's why their movies, cause that sense of wonders, because it's something you've never seen before.
I don't remember what it was. It was a preview on another Disney VHS, and they were talking about how they brought lions into, like, the animation studio.
It was for Lion King.
Was it?
Yeah, they were studying the movement of the lions so that they could get it right for Lion King. I remember that. I don't know what movie it was on.
I don't remember what it was
but
either.
But I remember exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. And I think that maybe they did it with tigers for Aladdin, too.
I'm sure they
did. I could have dreamed that up. Who knows?
Maybe.
So that's my primary, is, you know, taking you outside of yourself. The second is that it provokes a self-reflection, which is getting a little deep. Know, but you realize something about yourself when you walk out of that theater, or when you turn off your VHS player, which we all have and use frequently, I'm sure. But, you know, maybe it's something that you already know about yourself and you just have realized it at a deeper level or understood it at a deeper level. But there's always those nuggets that are in, you know, iconic Disney movies that you identify with and you understand at such a deep level because it's part of who you are. The third thing is that it permeates our cultural fabric way.
You gotta unpack that. Like, what?
So,
you know I'm slow.
Whether it's a song or a saying or something specific to that movie that then carries on through culture, pop culture, it's now something that we all know instinctively. It's a saying or a phrase that's part of just cultural vernacular. So that's a big part of it. I think that is a big identifier of a movie that's made a big impact.
Yeah, we talk about a lot on the show that you know, a lot of the things we talk about, whether it's, you know, comic book movies or now Disney movies or whatever, become just part of who we are as people. You know, like you grow up and I think you pop out of the womb knowing that Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father. So like you're absolutely right. You know, we were in Barnes and Noble the other night walking around and
right, I forgot about that.
And they were playing music and I knew I recognized the tune, but I couldn't place it. And I was like, what is this? I looked at you and I was like, what is this song from? You're like, it's from, and you named a random Disney movie.
I think it was Pocahontas.
It might have been Pocahontas.
Barnes & Noble was on their playlist that night, though. It was all Disney.
It was all Disney.
And
all
I didn't
want
to leave.
We stayed for an extra 10 minutes, I think.
We did. Yeah. I needed to finish a song.
You had to paint with all the colors of the wind. Had to paint with every single one of them.
Okay, so those are my big three. Are take you outside of yourself, provoking self-reflection, and then permeating cultural fabric. Mm-hmm. The added bonus is if it has a song that becomes ingrained in your head in the movie. Like, you walk out of the movie and you just know that song.
Yeah.
So it's kind of part of permeating the cultural fabric, because most of those will end up, you know, being those identifiable songs. But if it has that catchy song, then it's like, bam. Done.
Absolutely. Like, I remember the first time I watched Pocahontas, I knew the Colors of the Wind song, because that was that was like the trailer, like the 3-minute trailer was her singing right. Colors of the Wind, and I knew that song going in.
Well, you know, Colors of the Wind was my big fifth grade honor choir debut solo.
Really?
Was Colors of the Wind. I think that I only sang like 2 or 3 phrases of it, and I was actually the understudy.
Oh.
And she got sick and couldn't make it.
Clutch.
And I stepped up to that mic and I owned it.
Now, when you say she got sick.
Okay, I didn't have anything to do with it.
You sure?
No food poisoning, no, you know, because, like, I would have had to be sick, too, to get her sick.
Well, you could have like, you know, Tanya Harding'd her.
Yeah, I don't think that I was that that sneaky in fifth grade.
You sure?
I don't think so. We can ask my parents. I mean, I don't know.
It's worth an ask. I feel like the next family
dinner. But I owned that purple cummerbund and bow tie, and I rocked it.
I don't know how I haven't seen pictures of this. You guys are getting a weird insight into the Goodrich marriage. So, jumping in now, so we've established what a good Disney movie is. So now let's just dive in. So we're going to do one of our drafts. So how this will work is Adrienne will go first, and she has the entire spectrum of Disney films to pick from. Whatever she wants, whatever feels like a Disney film to her, like what, and there's no criteria, just like what, like if you're stranded on it, if you can only watch 3 Disney films, they don't have to be the best, they just have to resonate with you. So what would be your number one pick?
Yeah, this was hard for me because I like parameters, I like rules, I like criteria.
You are.
So having the entire, every Disney movie ever made was difficult.
You should see how I have to hang shirts in the closet.
Listen. Okay, you know what? We can go into that on a different episode.
It's okay.
I just like systems for things.
No, you're fine. You keep me out of trouble.
So my first draft pick is back from 1991.
1991.
The holiday feature that year for Disney, Beauty and the Beast.
Ooh.
Which is, you know, now being remade into live action. But there's just so many things about Beauty and the Beast. Going into just the making of it, you know, it was, it won 2 Oscars that year for best score and best song for Beauty and the Beast itself. Be Our Guest and Belle were also nominated that year.
Crushing it.
Totally crushing it in the music game. And all of those are, you know, super identifiable songs. So that goes into my number 3, as well as my added bonus of the catchy songs, multiple catchy songs in that movie.
You're referring back to it. I like that.
Right. Systems. Yeah. I want to make sure people know that I used my checklist to create this list. But, you know, Alan Menken, he also did the music for Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Pocahontas, Hercules, Hunchback. He won multiple Oscars for much of his Disney work. And he's actually coming back to do music for the live-action film, which I'm really excited about.
It's fantastic.
It was actually the first animated film to be nominated for Best Picture. Didn't win. I wish I could remember what it lost out to that year. But it was the first animated film to be nominated. But I loved, for me, well, first of all, it put Celine Dion on the map. So if there was no other reason to love Beauty and the Beast, it gave us Celine Dion.
Love? Really?
Listen, anyway. Well, again, another story for another episode. But, you know, it made reading cool for me as a young girl. The fact that Belle loved reading and the Beast ends up giving her the library. I remember as a little girl just being like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. And it wasn't about getting jewelry or clothes or anything like that. It was her knowledge that was so highlighted. I love the negative view of male chauvinism with Gaston and how she just kept pushing him off. And she was like, I don't need you. No thanks. And then also I love that it shows that you can overcome mob mentality for the greater good.
Okay.
So, you know, at the end when Gaston, you know, he's got the mirror and he's getting everybody worked up and they're going to go kill the Beast, you know, and they go. And then all of the all, you know, all of the creatures in the house, all of the housewares in the house, you know, they protect the castle, and they're able to overcome, even though all of this negativity is coming at them, and there's this mob mentality, and, you know, everyone is folded into the easy route, you know, the house and the creatures in the house protect it. And so, on so many levels, just seeing her relationship with the beast develop, and there, you know, I do have some hesitations about, you know, what does it say to young girls that, you know, if you love him enough, then he'll change. You know, so I do have that caveat.
Verbally and emotionally abusive boyfriend.
I will allow that. But on the whole, I mean, that doesn't get much more quintessential than Beauty and the Beast.
I'll allow it. And I think Emma Watson's probably not signed on.
I can't wait.
If all of that abusive, weird subtext is at least mitigated. No, it lost Best Picture to Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
So fantastic. Like, Bugsy, JFK, Prince of Tides, all that year, fantastic movies. No, I cannot disagree. That is, I get, like, you know, you don't get emotional watching movies and you get emotional in real life. I get emotional watching movies and don't really get emotional in real life. And so I get emotional the picture when the music swells and the air quotes camera swings around them as they're dancing.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
It's such a, like,
which
crushingly
was
beautiful shot.
The ballroom sequence is the first time that they'd used that type of animation as well. And so it goes back to that innovation as well that I, again, in my checklist,
yeah,
that I, you know, it was brand new in that way.
Yeah. If you guys are learning anything from this podcast, is that my wife is significantly smarter than I am.
I don't know about that.
So my first pick swings to the other end of the spectrum.
Let's hear it.
My first pick, and you totally know where I'm going with this, the not Pixar movie, the movie that honestly out-Pixar'd Pixar in a year where Pixar did a movie.
Really? It really did.
Wreck-It Ralph. Like,
fantastic.
Like, it for me, it doesn't get much better than Wreck-It Ralph. I mean, John C. Reilly, Sarah Silverman, like, it's hilarious, it's heartfelt. It plays on my nostalgia as, like, a nerd. Like, it's got all the video game references. It's got Zangief. It's got the Pac-Man ghosts. Like, it's got all of the old Atari games. I grew up playing Atari games. Like, my dad, I didn't have a video game system from, like, Atari, and then we jumped straight to, like, a Super Nintendo. It was, like, blew my mind. And so, like, it totally spoke to that. And then as a guy who dealt with a lot of self-confidence issues, you know, when I was growing up, it totally, like, hit me right in the feels. Like, I remember, you know, the scene where he's falling down and he's finally accepting that, like, I was created this way and that's okay. Like, where he's saying,
right,
that I'm bad and that's good and I may never be good, but that's okay. Like, I don't remember if I saw this with you or who I saw this with.
No,
but
actually, it was a group that went and saw it while we were, right before we started dating, I think. And I wasn't able to go. And then I think we took my little sister with Big Brothers Big Sisters.
We
I think
did.
You and I both took it. So
we
you had
did.
Already seen it. You had already prepped yourself.
I got the good cry out because I definitely cried when Ralph was crashing down and he was trying to save the whole world. He's like, this is what I was made to do. And then everybody accepts him. No, it totally speaks to so much. And it totally got robbed that year for Best Animated Picture because Brave won. And Brave is a good film, but when you put Brave and Wreck-It Ralph next to each other, there's not a contest in my mind.
I mean, have either one of us ever seen Brave?
I think I have.
I know for sure I haven't.
I think I watched it in, like, a doctor's office or, like, a waiting room or something.
So you didn't actually watch it.
Like, I sat and watched it.
Our
family doctor used to be routinely 2 hours late. I feel like I viewed the whole film.
Wow, that's special.
It is.
That takes talent to be that late consistently.
Well, there's a reason why we switched. No, so Wreck-It Ralph is my number one pick. So, Adrian, what is your number two?
You know, I'm going to stay in the same animation field, but go back to the original.
Okay.
This is what started it all for Pixar with the full-length feature films. And we're going to go again with the holiday feature of 1995.
The year of our Lord.
The year of our Lord, 1995 was a good year. Toy Story, the original.
Solid.
super, super solid. You know, I think that we can all identify with Woody's feelings when Buzz Lightyear shows up. You've been king of the castle, and then all of a sudden, you're no longer the cool kid anymore. But I think that something that's really special about Toy Story is that it's able to appeal at such a deep level to children while also appealing to the sensibilities of an adult, because it does have adult humor mixed in. Mm-hmm. And then also in the same way of appealing to that adult humor, also hitting on the notes of nostalgia for adults. It really is just such a broad range of appeal. It also got multiple Oscar nominations for Best Screenplay, Best Score, Original Song. You've Got a Friend in Me. I mean, you knew that when you walked out of the theater. You did. And you still sing. I think, didn't you use that in our wedding? You didn't end up using it.
Bare Necessities.
But, yeah, you used Bare Necessities in our wedding slideshow. Disney, but You've though. Got a Friend in Me was, I think...
It was a finalist.
You went Jungle Book. But, you know, it's so quintessential. To Infinity and Beyond. Like, kids these days are saying that, and they have no idea where it came from. Mm-hmm. So, completely permeated our cultural fabric. It gave us Pizza Planet. It gave us really the original Minions with the aliens. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, yep.
That was, you know, 20 years before Minions came out. Well, maybe not that far.
Yeah, about
mm-hmm. about that much. 15, 20 years before Minions. And it was like the first time where you see an Easter egg, a Pixar Easter egg of a different character, where you slow it down and you see, mm-hmm. you know, something flash by. And it started that whole... scavenger hunt in every Disney movie, and it's just such a key part to Disney, and just completely changed the way we do animation, the way we view animation, what we expect of animation, and the fact that it had two successful follow-up movies.
I would call them more than successful.
More than successful. I still don't think that you and I have watched Toy Story 3 together.
I refuse. You refuse
because of... the emotional...
I will weep every time.
You know, you said that you don't get emotional in movies.
No, I do. Oh, I don't get emotional in real life.
Oh, right. That's right. Whereas I get some... I want to clarify that. I get somewhat emotional in real life. And movies generally don't make me emotional.
Yeah. You're more emotional in real life than I am. But Goodriches go to counseling. That's going to be our next podcast.
Right. Yeah. So, but that's my number two pick, is the original Toy Story, for everything that the groundwork that it just laid for the following now 21 years.
Yeah. I could not pick a Toy Story film simply because I could not pick a Toy Story film. Like, they're all so, so good. And Toy Story 2 probably has the least real estate in my head for some reason. I'm not sure why. I think the first Toy Story has the nostalgia. Toy Story 3, I remember I went to see it with a coworker of mine, and like I had to apologize. I was like, I'm sorry. I just wept for 15 minutes, and I don't have the energy to talk to you. I've just got to go home. Like, I can't do this. Like, we were supposed to go grab food afterwards, and I'm like, I got to go home.
Wow.
Like, I can't do this. So, Toy Story is so much a part of what – and really Toy Story, I don't want to say saved Disney, but really, like –
it reinvented Disney.
Yeah, it reinvigorated what they were doing, because they kind of had, we were past the Disney Renaissance. They're kind of on the downhill slope, and then Toy Story came along, and you know, Disney and Pixar merged, and
it was a whole new world.
It was a whole new world. Perfect segue, monster. Thank you, dear. So my second pick, already spoiled. Thanks, babe.
Sorry.
It's fine. Is Aladdin. Like, I could not have a Disney discussion and not talk about Aladdin. Like, Aladdin to me, again, is going to go back to, like, my personal, like, my deep personal issues. Like, this should turn into a counseling session on the fly. Like, someone who's not okay with who they are and tries to pretend to be something else. I did a lot of that as a kid. That's honestly why I have my sense of humor, because I was like, I want to make fun of myself before anybody else does. And so, like, that's why I kind of have a sense of humor now. But no, like... when you talk about, like, iconic Disney characters, I don't know if there's anyone more iconic than Genie. Like, Robin Williams is, Like, there's no replacement. Like, that's the biggest thing that I'm really concerned about with Aladdin is what do you do with Genie? Because, like, Robin Williams is Genie. Like,
you can't 100%. Replicate it.
You cannot. There's no doing it. But A Whole New World, like, that song is like, it's a great ballad. Like, it's not just a great song for a Disney movie. It is a legitimately good ballad. Like, even, like, Carpet and Abu, like, mm-hmm. the non-verbal characters.
Raja.
Yeah, you have an affinity for cats that I don't. So, Raja probably speaks to you more than he speaks to me. But, you know, you talk about Jafar and Iago, like those iconic villains where, like, everybody knows Jafar. Like, you mentioned Jafar. Like, my tailor's name is Jafar. And and I told people, I got to go drop off my suit at Jafar. And, like, wait, Jafar, like, Aladdin Jafar? And I'm like, he's not a villain from a Disney movie.
He's not a sorcerer.
No, he's just a guy that does tailoring really, really cheap. so, like, it's you talk about permeating the cultural fabric. Aladdin has done that in spades. Like, A Whole New World, there's and I go back and watch it, and there are things that I catch now that I didn't catch as a kid.
Right.
Like, when all of the women, when they're talking, when Aladdin's, like, big introduction to all the women, I didn't get as a kid that it's a brothel and they hate him because he's broke. Like, I didn't get that. Obviously so, but now I'm like, oh.
Wait a minute.
Those are women of the night. They don't like him because he's broke. So, no, like, Aladdin, for me, and even, like, and this is gonna give you a little bit of a view into Gerald as a child, for those of you that didn't know me as a child, including everyone listening and you, I didn't just love Aladdin. Like, I made my parents buy the direct-to-tape sequels, Return of Jafar and Prince of Thieves.
Oh, man, now I was with you with Return of Jafar. Prince of Thieves
was not good. It was not good. Neither was Return of Jafar. Neither were good. But I owned them, and I loved them.
Of course.
I remember when we bought Prince of Thieves. It first came out. I was like, I saw it, like, as an advertisement somewhere, and I was like, Dad, we got to get this.
Got to have it.
And my dad was going to a Bible study at our church, and I sat in the kids' wing and watched it, like, three times.
Sounds
like
just about
back
right.
To back to back.
That does sound like a child Gerald.
It does.
And, you know, I went back and forth and really, really debated on whether or not to include Aladdin, because it does have such a special meaning for me. I went to Disney World as a family vacation as an adult, well, semi-adult. I was like 22.
Yeah, you're adultish.
I was adultish. But me and my sisters, you know, I have three sisters, my parents, we all went to Disney World as a family. And, you know, my sisters, they had gotten to see Belle, they had gotten to see Sleeping Beauty, you know, Aurora. They had gotten to see their Disney princesses at Magic Kingdom, which is where we were the first day. And I was like, guys, Jasmine isn't here. So when are we going to go to Epcot? Because she's in Morocco. So, you know, how are we going to do this? So the day that we went to Epcot, I was on a mission to find Jasmine. And I was in line for probably 20 minutes waiting to take a picture with Aladdin and Jasmine, and looked like such a cheese ball in that picture. But I was so excited because, you know, she was my Disney princess. I think as an adult, I've grown to appreciate Beauty and the Beast a little bit more, which is why I went ahead and included that as my number one draft pick. But Aladdin it was so hard to not choose it. I'm glad that you did, so that I can get some fulfillment out of that.
Good. I appreciate it. So what is your third pick? Bring us home.
Oh, man. This was tough. You know, my honorable mention list was 17 movies long. and that was actually even pared down a little bit.
I'm proud of you.
So I really struggled with this. And this one is a little bit out of left field. It's not a... well, it's very well known, but I won't say it's one that someone readily thinks of when they think of Disney movies. Mm. We're going back to the 60s, to 1964. And we're going to go with Mary Poppins.
Your love of British people strikes again.
It does. I mean, I just can't get away from it.
Nope.
But, you know, it had 13 Oscar nominations that year. And it won 5 of them for Best Actress, Julie Andrews. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't get much better than Julie Andrews. But also won for film editing, best original music score, visual effects for that year. Okay. You know, it combined the live action and the animation, as well as best original song for Chim Chim Cheree. Mm. Which is interesting because that's not the one that I identify most with.
That's the one I know, though. Like, I'm not a big Mary Poppins fan, but I know that song.
See, I immediately go with Spoonful of Sugar and Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Mm. I mean, hello.
I don't know if I could have picked all three of those out of the same film. Be really honest with you, I've seen Mary Poppins maybe once.
Well, it was, you know, growing up in a household of four girls, Mary Poppins was on repeat quite often. But even just looking at the story arc of the movie, since you've only seen it once, you probably don't remember this.
Negative.
Quick recap, it's about a wealthy British family. Father's a banker, doesn't have a great relationship with his kids. They keep running away their nannies. And so it starts out, the first scene is that the nanny, the most recent nanny, has quit. She can't handle it anymore. The kids have run away. She doesn't know where she is, and she's done. She's not going to look for him. The local constable brings them back. Come to find out, they were chasing a lost kite. Go through all of Mary Poppins.
Such a 1960s.
Oh, totally. Problem. Well, but it's set in like the 30s.
Yeah.
But you go through the complete story arc, and it finishes with George, who is the father, has finally connected with his kids, Jane and Michael, and he is taking them to fly a kite together as a family.
Let's go fly a kite.
See, that song too.
I guess I do.
But you know, and so he's...
I'm never singing again, by the way.
I doubt it. I bet we can get you one more time at least. But you know, it's that story of, you know, he's been putting his career first, his image first, and then finally Mary Poppins is able to break that in him, and he formulates this relationship with his parents, as a parent with his kids. And I remember as a kid being really more mesmerized by the cutaways, the cartoon scenes. You know, when they're on the carousel and the carousel horses come off and they start riding them through the countryside. When I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. The guy who plays the chimney sweep.
Wow, if you'd asked me for
what is wrong with me right now? I can't believe I'm forgetting this. This is so, like, crucial to the movie. Anyway, whenever all the chimney sweeps, whenever they're singing Chim Chim Cheree, and they're dancing around, and,
they're like six people yelling at us at home, because that's Dick Van Dyke.
Duh! Oh my gosh, I can't believe I forgot that. So, you know, Dick Van Dyke, obviously, you know, he's his one-man band. Tuppen's a bag. You know, the bird lady, you know, just little things throughout the movie. I also love that Winifred, the mother, was a suffragette. And I had no idea what a suffragette was growing up.
I still don't.
It was a woman who fought for the right to vote. She fought for suffrage.
Makes sense.
Okay. So, As a kid, I really have no idea what it is. She has this badge and she has this hat, and the husband's really put out that she's leaving to go to some rally for, you know, women's right to vote. And as a kid, that made no sense to me. But as an adult, I'm like, that is awesome that they included that.
It's very fitting.
And so it just has so many cool things. It literally takes you out of this world and takes you into the cartoon world where anything is possible, where they're drawing with chalk and then suddenly they're jumping into the chalk drawings. Yeah. Chalk drawings. We're going to be British about it.
Absolutely. Now, I don't have much of a cultural touchstone for Mary Poppins other than, you know, seeing... Yeah, I hear you and your sisters talk about it. Yeah, it's such a part of the fabric. I'm not surprised that it was on your list. So my last one is also very off the beaten path. Like, when you think of Disney movies, most people don't think of this. But it has such a huge part of me. It's a Goofy movie is what it's called. And if you haven't seen a Goofy movie, it's like an hour and 5 minutes. So it's a super short investment. But it's a movie that is literally about a father trying to connect with his son. Like, that is when push comes to shove. And, you know, one, it's hilarious. Like, it's really, really funny. The music is fantastic. Like,
it is.
The music is great. And you've got Kevin Campbell playing Powerline is like the Michael Jackson analog. Right. And, it's great music. But, like, there's such a deep heart to this movie. Like, it gets me emotional. Like, even thinking about, like, now, you know, you and I are about to have a son. And, like, thinking about finding ways to connect and you know, the really tragedy of parents that don't know how to connect with their kids.
Right.
It really it spoke to me on a deep level then, because I have a very, very close relationship with my father. And now thinking of having a son and wanting to have that same kind of relationship with him, like finding new ways to connect and get on their level. Like it is totally like if you put me in a room and say like, hey, you have to watch one Disney movie for the rest of your life, a Goofy movie is definitely on that list.
Are you getting teary right now? I can't tell.
No, I'm clear eyes, full hearts. Come on.
Okay. No, I totally, this is one that I know your deep, deep love of. And so I would have been surprised if it wasn't on your list. I know that if it wasn't, it would have been a very top of the honorable mention.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't have, in the same way that you don't have a whole lot of cultural touchstone for Mary Poppins, I don't for Goofy movie. I remember watching it in school when we would have movie days, because it was about the time of one of our periods in middle school. I remember The Leaning Tower of Cheesa.
Yeah.
I do remember that. And I do remember Powerline and his performance.
Stand out above the crowd.
Stand out.
Even if I got a shout out loud.
Wow.
Yeah, I could sing that song.
I wish you would.
I won't. but I won't.
But I know that especially men of a certain age, particularly yours, that is a movie that they identify so deeply with, because it does hit on so many of those, you know, topics.
Absolutely. And it launched a whole like Goofy TV show. It launched, like, they had another movie that's on Netflix. Like, I cannot find a Goofy movie anywhere. Like, I'm fixing to just go buy it because I want to watch it and I want to have it for our children.
Right.
So that is our Disney drafts, and that brings us to our favorite segment of the week, the segment that I think brought you so much anxiety heading into this show, Don't Sleep on It. So, Adrian, what is your Don't Sleep?
You know, it did bring me a lot of anxiety because I feel like I'm oftentimes not as clever or as culturally tuned in as you and our dear friend Raymond. So I was afraid I was going to pick something kind of dorky. But I decided to embrace my dorkiness.
Embrace it, babe.
Because it's something that is just so integral to my being.
Mm-hmm.
But I chose a documentary from 2008 called Pressure Cooker.
Okay.
And so, which is really not identifiable of anything until you learn about what it's about. But it is about this no-nonsense drill sergeant-like culinary instructor. And she takes these low-income, working-class family kids in northeastern Philadelphia and takes them through this culinary program. And the culmination of the program is that they go to this culinary competition where they're able to earn these relatively huge scholarships for college that they wouldn't be able to earn otherwise. And so you watch these kids all the way through, and you start out with them really being frustrated by this teacher, because, I mean, she's just like this hard nose, doesn't take any crap from these kids. And they're really frustrated because she's like, my knife is sharp, or, you know, I did cut that the right way, but it's not perfect, so she doesn't accept it. And so it's just this relationship with them. And you follow them all the way through, and it reminds me a lot of like a sports documentary, like Last Chance U or something like that. And at the end of it, you're like, who's going to get a scholarship? Who's going to get succeed? And your heart swells with pride as you're watching certain students get these things, and it explains their family histories. And, you know, it's just this incredible, feeling, and it really marries my love of cooking. Which anyone who knows me longer than about 5 minutes knows that cooking is like my jam.
It is.
And I actually asked you tonight if we could just do a cooking show, but you said not tonight.
No, that's not really the jam of the podcast.
Maybe one of these days.
Yeah.
But it marries my love of cooking, and also, you know, I have a big passion for education and serving underprivileged students, and so it's kind of me meshed into a documentary.
Very you.
Yeah. So that is my Don't Sleep on It, Pressure Cooker. It is not on Netflix anymore, which is where I originally watched it, but I do believe it's on Amazon Prime. Go check it out when you just need like a good like Stand By Me, or not Stand By Me. What's that movie with Morgan Freeman?
Yeah, Stand By Me.
It is it? Okay. I think,
is it Stand By Me? Stand and Deliver?
Stand and Deliver. Stand and Deliver. It. Stand By Me is a totally different movie from the 80s.
Totally different. Yeah. Do they play Stand By Me in Stand and Deliver? I think we need to go back and watch that.
We'll have to watch it.
Yeah, we will.
But yeah.
Okay. So my Don't Sleep for this week is it was actually a news item from a few, probably a month or so ago on the show, but it was finally released. Marvel has released Genndy Tartakovsky's Cage comic, and it is a stylized Luke Cage comic, like set in the original Blaxploitation era when the Luke Cage comic originally debuted. But it's got that distinctive Genndy Tartakovsky animation style. So if you don't know who he is the animation genius behind Ed, Edd n Eddy, Powerpuff Girls, Samurai Jack, Dexter's Laboratory, anything that was Cartoon Network in the early 2000s that a lot of us identify with is this man. And if you've ever watched his animated Clone Wars cartoons, which I own and love, they're not canon anymore, but they're fantastic. It has that classic animation style that I so love. There's like a scene where Luke Cage is trying to get some information, and there's this guy in a jail cell, and he grabs him by the throat, and he looks like if Ed with two D's, double D, went on like a 6-year cocaine binge. Like, it looks just like him in the face. He's got like the beanie and everything.
Wow.
But he's like a druggie. It's really good. My biggest beef with it is that Luke Cage is a bit of a jerk. Like, he's kind of just a D-bag at times. But like, the animation is so striking. I haven't ever been like a weekly or monthly comic guy since I was a little kid, but this is something that's worth $4 a week. It's only going to be 4 issues, so it's like a $16 investment.
Are you prepping me for this?
I'm just letting you know.
Okay,
now. They just build $16 into our budget.
I think we can handle
okay,
it.
Okay, perfect. So yeah, My Don't Sleep is the new Cage comic. Hit up your local comic book shop. Go check it out. It is totally worth the $4 investment. If you're into the digital thing, Marvel Unlimited has it on there as well. So check it out. Cage. It's literally Cage with an exclamation point. Do not miss it.
But get the printed copy.
Get the printed copy. Come on. Like, support your local comic book shop.
Just do it.
Just do it. Support local businesses.
There you go. All right,
so that brings us to the end of our show tonight. If you made it this far, then you clearly like what we have going on, or you just wanted to see what other really random, like, couples therapy things would happen on this show.
There's always next time.
There's always next time. We got a Harry Potter show coming up here in a couple of weeks. So if you like the show, man, help us out. Leave us a review on iTunes. Share the link. We're going to tweet it out. Guys, it really helps the visibility. So thank you so much for checking us out. Adrian, where can they find you on social media?
You can find me on Instagram and the tweeting machine.
Tweeting machine.
At Mrs. G.H. Goodridge. So MRS G.H. Goodridge. Not super active on the tweeting machine, but much more active on Instagram.
Yep, she is an avid food photographer if I've ever seen one. So check her out at Miss GH. Don't slide in those DMs, though. I will come after you. You can find me on Twitter at GH Gertridge. You can find Ray on Twitter at RM Summerlin. Check him out at Roto World. We're going to get him back on the show here again in a couple weeks, guys. But until we return, stay woke.
Stay woke, y'all.